I went back to Chicago in the fall of 1928, and I had this training, this job prospect there with the Common Editor Company, and they, in the first year, they put us out for in 3 months period to different places in the organization to kind of get background and learn the ropes. So the first year, they sent me up to Waukegan, north of Chicago, and I spent 3 months there, put me out with a line crew. And then the next 3 months, they brought me back and sent me out to West Chicago, which is about 30 miles west out there along the head of the Mississippi River. And I was again on a crew that encompassed some line work planning, but sometimes the actual work that you got done on some of these assignments was minimal. And then the next time I was 3 months, I was sent down to the south side of Chicago, and I lived down there at way down opposite the park that ran along the lakefront. And they assigned me to a period in the generating station down in the Calumet generating station, which actually is down almost to the Illinois line.
Oscar, let me introduce you here, okay? I'm visiting with Oscar Yoder, a longtime rancher and resident of the southern part of Goshen County. Oscar Yoder, his family goes back quite a number of years, and I'm doing the interview for the project, the Spirit of Survival, Voices from the Depression. I'm visiting with Oscar Yoder here at Eastern Wyoming College on January the 6th, 1986. And Oscar has been a past legislator, has served 3 terms. Isn't that right, Oscar?
Three terms in the House.
And also then a term in the State Senate in the years from 1965 to 1975, and has been active in the Wyoming Stock Growers Association.
May I make one correction here on dates, Don? It was really from 1955 to about 65.
Okay.
I think I told you wrong.
Legislator then, mm-hmm. 1955 to 1965, and then also active in the Stock Growers Association and serving as vice president during the 1960s. Oscar, thank you for visiting with me. What year were you born, Oscar?
Well, I was born in 10-10-03.
Whereabouts?
I was born on a ranch about 5 or 6 miles west of Kimball. My father filed on a homestead down below the Lone Tree Hill, down what they call the McGinney, and in the mid-90s. And it was there he married and lived there for a period. During this period, he formed a partnership with his brother, Oscar. And in the filing on the homestead, my mother filed on 160 and a father on the other. 160 was all you could file on in those years. So they had this 320, and of course it was open range around them. And it was during this period that with my uncle, he ran the store in LaGrange for a period. And they were postmasters, each in turn, for a short period of time in LaGrange. He droughted out and grasshoppered out and then eventually sold his place to the Swan Land and Cattle Company. He then moved to and bought a ranch about 5 or 6 miles west of Kimball, and it was here that I was born.
That was the date. Now, when, give that date to me again, Oscar. Yeah.
Well, in I was born in October 10th, 1903.
Oscar, what were some of your reflections of growing up then?
Well, after my in the 1905, then was a very frustrating bad year for my father. His own mother passed away. My mother passed away in 1905. And then I had an older brother that was drowned in a ditch in 1905. And when my mother passed away, he took me and let my Ida Clark, an aunt, a sister of my father's, raise me, Aunt Ida and Uncle Doc. And my first recollections were when I grew up within memory with them. My father bought the Dollar Ranch on Bear Creek in 1905, and he made no use of it at first that I know of. And in this period, Uncle Doc and Ida lived on the Dollar Ranch there with Helen and I as being the children of the family there. Then in 1910, my father remarried, and I had a new stepsister, Marion, who was about my age. We were both born in the same year. And then in 1913, he moved us to Torrington to live in a home that he had built here. During this period of time, my father was ranching all the time, and he utilized quite a bit of the area in Goshen Hole that he could acquire. He leased most of the grazing land that the Lincoln Land Company had in Goshen Hole, and he bought the Stemler place, which we later called the KJ. It is now owned by the Ed Johnsons and LaGrange, that particular Stemler place. The lands that of the Lincoln land that he had leased were the Herrick west of the Y Cross, the 66 Meta area and pasture lands west, the Rock Ranch, and I believe the Doty was a Lincoln land place which he used for a period of time. Then in 1918, he moved the family to Cheyenne to the Harrington House, insomuch as Marion and I were ready for high school in the fall of 1917. He sent us over to Cheyenne to board with a sister of my Uncle Doc, Daisy Christensen.
Uncle Doc? Can I ask that, Oscar?
Yes, Doc Clark. He was a nickname that he acquired probably as a young fellow, and he used it. He signed his name F. Doc Clark, D-O-C. And he was raised in Cheyenne.
What did he do, Oscar?
Well, then his active year, he ranched, and he homesteaded down on Horse Creek in this period of time. And then he came and lived on the old grandfather's place there on Bear Creek, where I am currently.
Well, you were then in Cheyenne going to high school then.
Well, my father sent us over then to high school, so we would ahead of them to board with this Tony and Daisy Christensen. However, I just got started good in high school, and I came down with a scarlet fever. A girl came to school all broken out in our room, and it was a rather rough disease possibly then, because I was in quarantine for 6 weeks, and Grandma Farthing, that is my stepmother's mother, took me in tow and went and down at 1815 Central and nursed me through this period of with scarlet fever. Then I got rheumatic fever out of that, and so my father decided that he'd take me down to Excelsior Springs, Missouri, see if that would help me. But as we went east, of course we traveled by train, as I got to the lower elevation, the rheumatism pains left me, and I arrived down there without any particular discomfort. This Excelsior Springs was east of Kansas City, and it was there that I had the good fortune to say that I met Charlie Coffey, who my father knew. He was wintering there, and Charlie Coffey had to be in his senior years then. Coffey claimed, indicated that he was the first to winter cattle in Goshen Hole and stay with them and take care of them. He did not say that he brought the first cattle into Goshen Hole.
What was your impression of Charlie Coffey?
Well, I'll tell you, I will have to admit that he was, to me as a boy, was an older man, and I regret that my impression of him is that I had at the time has escaped me. He gave a little dinner party one evening there for the ones he knew, including my father, and I think my status and at that particular time was probably emphasized by the place card that was put at my plate, Sonny Yoder.
Oscar, your father was quite a leader in the building of Goshen County. He was, as you mentioned to me, the first member from Goshen County in the House of Representatives when it was organized in 1913. I know that he was involved in a number of economic activities. What were some of those things that he was involved with, Oscar? This was, your father's name was Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah, B.F., B.F. Yoder. Well, he and his brother Jess were on an organizational group that started the Hawk Springs Reservoir Project. I think my father came back off of that rather early. As I indicated before, he moved us from Bear Creek to Torrington. And in that period, we finished our grade schooling there. When Goshen County was split off from Laramie County, Platte and Goshen were made separate entities out of the original Laramie County. He was appointed on the organizational board, and then when it was turned, then it was turned over to an elected board of county commissioners. Then he ran and for the legislature and served as a House member for two terms, and then he wound up his legislative activities at that point. He was a mayor of Torrington for about a year and a half during this period of living there, and then in 1918 he formally moved the family to Cheyenne into the Harrington home.
Why was it called the Harrington?
Well, there was a John Harrington had built this house. It was at the corner of 21st and Warren. It was a large two-story home on the corner, and finally, now there was a commercial building on that corner. It was during the in the Depression era of after World War I, my father got caught in the slide of values of everything, and he was too extended, I think, in too many banks, and he had financial reverses during this period of time.
What do you remember most about your father, Oscar? What kind of man was he?
Well, he had an outgoing personality, apparently. He came back to my sister, Marion, and I. We attended school at the University of Nebraska. She went down one year ahead of me because I lost a year in high school with my bout with scarlet fever. We attended the Methodist Church in Lincoln, and occasionally, I don't know how, not too faithfully, probably. And we probably shook hands with the minister at the end of the service. My father came back one time on the train to visit us. He ran into the minister on the train, and by the time he got to Lincoln, he knew our minister better than we ever did. My father was born on a small farm on the outskirts of Shanesville, Ohio. and in a small farm home, which I have seen. It was well kept up even when I was there. There's a family, there's a nice cemetery on the outskirts of Shanesville, in which well kept up, in which the early ones of our family are buried. I noticed within the confines of the family grave plot there was a more modern stone that indicated, which merely indicated it was a Yoder section of the cemetery, and it was looked much like the one that is in Cheyenne, and it aroused my curiosity. And in visiting with an Alice Shutt, who was a Yoder, her married name Shutt, and visiting with her father, whose name was Shutt too, I brought up the subject of this stone on the cemetery, and I wondered why and what about it. Well, he said your father came back through here one time on his way from an eastern trip, Washington, I think, and he commissioned me to have this stone put on the cemetery, and he left me the money to do it with.
Was your father a large man, Oscar?
He was
the appearance of
the father? Well, he was rather short and stocky. And he weighed about 210 pounds, though, in his prime. Quite a rugged person. Now, my uncle, Jess Yoder, who was a brother, and Oscar, they were taller and a little slimmer built. My father used to say that they were millers. There was a miller strain in the family that produced some different characteristics. My brother Jack was lighter colored and slimmer and taller, and well, he would say he's a miller.
Well, your father and what? Several brothers came out to this country?
Well, my father and grandfather came first in 1881, and I believe that, and I know that Alex Swan, was an influence of him coming here. My grandfather moved first to the Sugar Creek area of Iowa, and there he farmed for a period of time. I think a disease in the swine family was a bit of his undoing, and he hadn't put it together financially yet, and they came on out to Wyoming, and I always felt that the Alex Swan was probably the influence of them looking over the general Cheyenne area north. So they came out here in 1881, and then the family came a year later, and they lived in a home on the edge of Cheyenne that Alex Swan at that time owned. He advised them to bring a hay baler with them, and that's which they did. And in getting established, why, they bought a relinquishment on Bear Creek of 160, and then he filed on an additional 160 under the what they call the Timber Act, I believe it was. And it was there they finally took root and established the place. My grandfather, he raised horses and he would break out workhorses and occasionally ship them back to Iowa to sell.
Well, now, when did they build the stone house that which you live in on Bear Creek?
Well, just before the turn of the century. They put an 1899 date on it, and I think that they were probably two or three years, a period of time, building it and getting ready to build it with all the rock that was necessary to haul. And my grandfather built the home there. They lived in a log house not very far away, almost in the lower yard from the main house. My father lived there as he grew up, of course, but he never, other than a brief time after he was remarried, we never lived in the home for any long period of time. And he bought the Dollar Ranch in 1905, and we moved up there about 1910.
Your father then began to kind of expand his own business interests about around 1900, so that By the time you were growing up, Oscar, he was what, becoming a fairly wealthy man?
Well, I think he was well off financially until the Depression after World War I came along, and he was extended, I think, in probably side banking interest that was outside of the direct cattle business, which I think he knew real well. And I think that Depression was what was his probably financial reverse period.
When he came, however, though, to the Bear Creek Valley and first began, he was starting right from scratch, so to speak, wasn't he, Austin?
Well, he started his ranching operations, I think, in a very modest way, probably, during his homestead days down below the Fox Creek Gap and below the Lone Tree down the drainage that runs east there. And then what ranching interest he had in that period, he probably moved what cattle he had maybe to Kimball down there. It wasn't too far across the Kimball area. And I do not know just how extensive his ranch holdings were in that period. Not too.
Did you, as a young boy growing up, on the early ranch and then in Torrington, did you get to know quite a bit of your father's business? Did he talk much about the business to your mother? And did you have a pretty good idea of what was going on in those years?
Well, I think I learned my part of that during that period, I think, was the learning of how to run and look after cattle. He hired Carl Spencer to be his chief operator as far as the cattle goes, and I rate that Carl Spencer was probably one of the best all-around hands that I ever came in contact with. He was my father had one characteristic of nicknames. He the rhyme or reason of some of the nicknames, I do not know. Some I do. Now, Carl Spencer was Winter Ringer. I don't know why. I sense that my father had a lot of respect for Carl Spencer. Frank Jones was Rainwater. Why Rainwater? Because there was a Rainwater Jones in years past. And Doc Clark was Middleton. Why Middleton? There was a famous horse thief by the name of Doc Middleton. The Griffin brothers was Uncle Jim and Aunt Kurt. My Bump Miskimmins, he gave him the name Bump. Quite a few did not know Bump's really given name, which was William. My own particular nickname was probably not too, well, it was Donnie. Why Donnie? I don't know. Perhaps I didn't look too rugged. Nobody else called me that. I did not know, though, of anyone that he nicknamed that were not close to him or who he respected.
He must have been a likable man, Oscar, and a very persuasive man.
Well, apparently so, because he had the ability to get acquainted readily, and I admired the energy and the push and drive that he had. It's possible maybe he had a wee bit too much of it. I don't know if that's possible.
Oscar, was it your intention then, once you had graduated from the University of Nebraska, to come back to the ranch?
At that time, I would say that I did not have perhaps a clear picture of what I was going to do eventually. I got an engineering education, and I thought, and that was what kind of my bent, and I and I started out to see what that might lead into, and took this job for that period of time. I did not give up the thought of completely abandoning the ranching business, because my father had me established in the ranching business, whether I wanted to be in it or not, and because of the, so when he asked me to come home, I felt obligated to, and that I did.
Now, you graduated from University of Nebraska, is that correct?
Yes,
Oscar?
Yes.
And with a degree in engineering.
In electrical engineering.
What year was that, Oscar?
Yeah, that was in the year of 1926.
Where did you go from there?
Well, then I took this job in Chicago in the fall of that year, and I spent 2 years back there, for a first year in a rather a training routine, or less, I think it's better put, in an orientation routine, to see the different phases of the electrical power industry, to see what you might like or might work into. And I finally found a spot in the testing department.
What company was that?
It was the Commonwealth Edison Company. Now, the Commonwealth Edison Company served the area within the corporate limits of Chicago, and they also had a corporate interest in the I'm trying to think of the correct name of the Public Service Company of Northern Illinois, which surrounded Chicago. And some of our activities in getting oriented were outside of the corporate limits of Chicago. There was one interesting thing, I think, as far as the industry within Chicago was, that the downtown section of Chicago, even in those years, was still served by direct current. And to maintain this power supply for the downtown part of Chicago, they had to maintain large rotary converters. And these were in substations way down, some of them down below, two stories below the ground level. And they were finely kept up and well lighted and ventilated and all of that. Then gradually, as the years went on for that, they phased out the direct current part of it. But that was an interesting period of time. Now, the Commonwealth Edison Company installed the first turbine generator in the United States, and it was purchased in England, and it was shipped the entire way from England to Chicago by water through the Great Lakes chain. It was very small by today's standard, but it was very progressive company, and the Commonwealth Edison Company now is still one of the strong public utilities in the nation.
Oscar, I want to continue this on the other side of the tape. Oscar, continuing on, you were working as an electrical engineer in Chicago. What year did you return back to the ranch at Bear Creek?
Well, I returned from Chicago in the spring of 1928. My father then had the KJ there at LaGrange, and that was my basic, probably the place where I returned to. Doc Clark and Aunt Ida were still living on the old home place up on Bear Creek at that time. So we were busy moving cattle around, and my father took in between 1,100 steers to summer, and he scared up area and pasture for them. And I remember that we moved them from. During this period of time, he had a stretch of the land along Horse Creek from J. Penn's on down toward the, not to the state line, but down quite a ways toward the state line, and we had a cow camp down there at where the so-called Horse Creek Lateral came out of Horse Creek. Horse Creek was used as a secondary canal from where the main canal crossed Horse Creek west, east of Yoder, down to this where the Horse Creek Canal came out. And it was this pasture land along the creek there that he had leased. Partially from, some of it was government land, some of it was from the Lincoln land. And we had a cow camp there at this junction point. And then we were quite well scattered in the operations between, the Dater pasture, the Horse Creek pasture, Bogville, and then some of these cattle we moved up north of the river, just north of Lingle.
Now you moved back because your father had asked you to come back. Was it because of depression conditions, Oscar?
No. I would say possibly some of the conditions that arose after the World War I Depression era, because my father was quite extended. He had to withdraw some of the things that he had operated in, and he asked me to come home and give him a hand, and I did. And he was still kind of trying to get his feet under him from the original Depression era. So we graduated off into the 30s rather slowly going along. I think the thing that I remember most about the worst year of the 30 Depression, 34, was the extreme dry year that it was with grasshoppers. And the thing that I think bothered us the worst was the lack of grass and feed, and we spent a good portion, so much of the winter of 34-35, finding places to put cattle. We had cattle scattered from up in Platte County to the west of, on top, and then we leased some feed, or bought some feed, and used some across the river from Torrington there.
Well, Oscar, was that the worst year of the 30s, 1934?
In my estimation, yes, because of we finally had a wet spring. The grass had taken such a beating in 34 that it didn't look like, even with the good late April moisture that we had, that there was going to have grass for a long time. And we took a trip up to the ranch north of Manville, down into that area there, to take a look at a possible place to put cattle. But by the 1st of June, the moisture took effect, and we had grass at home and got by without having to move clear on out.
Dry years were broken then, evidently, by that wet spring.
Yes, I would say so. That doesn't mean that all the years were fine and favorable after that, but in my memory, that 34 was the worst.
What did the country look like? Did you look out across the country today, and can you imagine what it was like back then? Can you still visualize how dry it was, I guess?
Well, I think the worst phase of being during that dry area was that the fact that land that was farmed was unable to raise decent crops, and I think Grush and Thistles grew up so much on some of this, and some of the land got to blowing. Strip farming, I don't think, was established too much, and there was too much block farming, and there was too much open land to blow. And I can remember some of the real bad, dirty, windy days in the 30s in which I can't think of anything much more depressing than one of those windy days with the dirt blowing.
What about the condition of your cattle in the dry years there?
Well, this summer of 34 was tough because we were unable to acquire enough decent grass, and we moved them around to where there was some old grass that hadn't been used for a period of time, And some of the cattle went into the winter in a, you might say, weak spring condition when they, and when fall came. They were not up to what they were. And then we had that one storm in April, which I say broke, as far as we were concerned, broke the drought cycle. And they did not fare too good, and we lost quite a few cattle in that one spring storm. It wasn't that the storm was so... It wasn't what you would say was really a bad storm, excepting it was wet and chilly and cold and caused some of the weaker cows to die.
You went back to the ranch, so in 1928, were there dry years then before 1934? When did you begin noticing? Do you recall? Was it years before?
Well, in my memory... 34 was the bad year, and I think the others were more or less average. Our average rainfall in this area is about 15 inches, but it is around 15 inches, and of course it's important that the moisture comes at the time that it should. There's an old saying that if April is right, the season's right, but that's a little oversimplification, and September can normally be a very dry month and yet still go into the winter with pretty good feed.
What about along Bear Creek, Oscar? What was it like along? That's generally a rather nice area down there along Bear Creek. Did that get pretty dry right through there as well?
Well, it did not escape the dry cycle any more than the rest of the area. And there were some dry years in which the hay crop didn't amount to very much, I'll tell you. And the hoppers were bad at least in 34 and in years after that. And at first there were no real effective methods of controlling grasshoppers. They came out with a dry poison bran, and they developed some bran spreaders later. At one period of time, we just hand scattered some poison bran, hoping to be effective, but it was like trying to battle a windmill, I think, with a broomstick to shut it off.
What did it force any of those ranchers, do you recall, to go under? What happened to ranchers?
Well, I think financing entered into some of the quite a bit in the ranching industry, and the cattle prices got so low that it didn't solve too much by selling cattle, because they were only worth, we sold yearlings in the fall of 34 for $3.50 a hundred, and the drought was so bad that the government initiated a kind of a cull cow program, in which they took and bought cattle for $18 a head and destroyed cattle. That was an odd phase at time. The banks, and when I say banks, we were banking in Cheyenne, and the government set up what they call the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to help finance cattle people, and the banks then could, and they took and shoved some of their loans, and I say some, it looked to me like most of what they had, into this Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and the prices got to the point there's only one way they could go, hold even or go up. I know, without naming any specific banks, which were none of our local banks here, I know I heard one or two say, when I get on my feet, I'm not going to go back. I'm not going to go back there, and which they did. Most of them waited. Wanted out.
Well, could a rancher at that time then go in and borrow money from the bank under, and this money was backed up by the Reconstruction?
No, it was a case of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation actually taking the loan over. completely.
So you were really a ranch.
You might say you ceased to be a customer of the bank when they come over.
Uh-huh. Did that save though? Did the Reconstruction Finance Corporation help to save ranchers?
Well, I would say that they formed an important niche, at least an important niche for the banks, because they shoved loans that they should have ridden through on their own and could have ridden through on their own and didn't. And it was some of the ones that were caught in those circumstances decided that, well, you didn't continue to back me up now. I'm not coming back there. And I heard that remark a few times. And that was the start of the Production Credit Association. Then the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was the start of, you might say, the federal farm credit system, I believe. And then they went on through, and many of them got back on their feet, okay, financially.
Mm-hmm. But those were tough times for ranchers.
Yes, they were, and not easy. But now land, it affected land prices. Land that would probably bring selling for $10 or $12 an acre ahead of that depression, you could buy probably all the land you wanted for from $2 to $2.50 an acre. And I know you. In the case of some life insurance companies that wound up with land as collateral in loans that they had made, you could, if you would go ahead and assume the obligation, you could buy land with probably little or nothing down if you just say, well, I'll just go on with it. And I think the point was that you bought land, all right, but you couldn't see far enough down the road. I think instead of buying, say, as much as you did, you should have bought two or three times as much as you did. I mean, by hook or crook or tying it up, because land values then came back up. Not to the point that they are today, but those were different dollars in those days, too.
Oscar, was a case where some ranchers then had to sell off land while other ranchers were able to...
Well, I can't recall that... Many of the basic established ranches sold out. They just hung on. But then there were some that come to retirement age, and some maybe kind of wanted out, a change out. But I can't recall that of ranchers getting caught in a foreclosure pinch. They just if they wanted to go on and battle it out, they did. And I think the ones that... But some were established and owned enough land in their own right that they could go on through and make it.
Well, now, you were looking for grass for your cattle in the summer of 1934. About how many cattle were you running?
Well, I remember that we weaned... I believe just ahead of that, we weaned between 300 and 400 head of calves up there at Bogville and took them down to LaGrange to winter. So I think we were probably running between 400 head of cows.
What kind of cattle were these?
Herefords.
Were there any other kinds of cattle beside Hereford in the area at that time?
Very few that I knew of. They hadn't come into the exotics or these crossbreeding at that period of time, and they were essentially Hereford cattle in this area.
Now, you mentioned you got, what, $3.50 a hundredweight?
Well, that was an extreme price, but I mean, it was an extreme year or two. The $12 would buy the best calf in the country.
But also then the government had a program in which, as you mentioned, they would come out and buy for, what, $18 a head?
That was, that was a kind of an emergency program it was assumed that what they would buy these probably essentially cull cows, or cows that you normally would get rid of in the fall, and there just wasn't a market for them, and they took some of them off of the market.
And did your father sell any of his cattle?
Well, we sold a few. We sold some, but I can't tell you now how many. Not too many, I don't think. We went through the winter with too many cattle, and probably some without the normal condition that they should have in the fall. And in that spring storm of 35, we lost quite a number. But then it was, the saving thing was there that we had moisture and the prospects of feed grass.
Oscar, you didn't have to sell those cows, though. Is that correct?
No, that's right. No, that was your choice.
Once you had sold, though, some of your cows, what was done with those cows?
Well, frankly, some of them, they were just destroyed.
Right on the ranch itself, or were they?
Well, I think they bunched them up in a place. In one, and these, there were. I do know that after that bad winter, there were some of these cows that were probably destroyed, and some were lost in storms. They were gathered in a certain place, and I think there were truckloads of bones that were trucked out of the area.
How did ranchers feel about that government program of buying?
Well, you know, I don't. I think maybe that the times are so tough that they probably appreciated maybe that here was some help if we choose to take it. But I think as a whole, most ranchers were kind of independent sort of people, and I don't think they sought this type of help. I don't think they pushed it. I'm quite sure they didn't.
You know, about in the early 1930s, the Taylor Grazing Act was passed. And I don't know if you recall that. That was a situation where the government decided that it would lease its grazing lands to cattlemen. Do you have any recollection?
Well, I'll tell you, I want to point out one thing. The southeast part of Wyoming is one of the favored parts of the state of the state of Wyoming, and you will notice that there was, and after through the homestead days, and when I say the homestead days, I feel that the era starting about 1913-14 on up through the teens and then finally into the 20s, all this loose land in this southeastern Wyoming, practically all of it was homesteaded. So when it came around to this Taylor grazing thing, it was not a factor in the southeast part of Wyoming, and we did not have that to contend with. What isolated tracts of land that was left, they were really isolated and not in any shape to be homesteaded as homesteads, because the teens before these bad years, it was taken up, and this Taylor grazing did not enter into this particular area. And I'm not a good source of information on how that affected certain areas. And I still have a feeling that we're living in one of the best parts of Wyoming here. And I still think that Torrington is one of the good, modest little towns in Wyoming.
Oscar, what about ranchers during the 1930s? Did they organize together? Did they do anything to help themselves through those tough times?
Not that I can recall. I can't know. And I do not. I'm not a source of information as what was the impetus of forming this Reconstruction Finance Corporation. I should do a little personal research on that. The reason that some of us got involved in that was I would say that here it was, a certain bank that was bankrolling us said they didn't give you too much choice. We're transferring you.
Oscar, you've been in the ranching business since 1928, and we've had some dry years. In fact, the last couple of years have been rather dry. Have conditions on the range ever been as bad as they were back in the early 1930s?
I can't recall that they have been. No, I would think that would be a kind of a banner dry year. But to say that there weren't other bad years ahead of that, and we've had some dry years since. But there is a tendency, even now, I think, maybe to run a few more cattle than you really should on a given area. And I think there's even a tendency today to overgraze some and depend on extra feed when a little easing up on the grazing, a little grass and cake can take a place of a lot of hay up to a calving point.
Oscar, do you think that was a lesson that ranchers learned as a result of the Depression? That they became a little more concerned about the grass?
Oh.
Did that make a difference?
You're asking me a question which I'd have to think about and probably more of a little bit of a supposition. No doubt it might have alerted some to the necessity of having... try to having a little more reserved grazing room without having to depend too much on the current season's moisture. Try to have a little more lightly grazed areas to fall back on. I think if there was any lesson in it, that. But that would vary with individual ranchers. I think this era probably helped change methods of our dry land farming and not get away from so much block open area farming and where you take a crop off every other year instead of just going back over and over the same ground.
Well, I was wondering about that in ranching. If as a result of the Depression, that ranchers then begin to change some of their ranch practices?
Well, possibly to a degree, but I think each individual rancher maybe operated just a little bit different from the other. It was a period of time, though, when there were so many shaken out of, some were shaken out of the ranching and some farmers out of farming, and then some ranchers patiently and quietly over a period of time acquired more elbow room to operate. And I think maybe that was one thing that those years brought on. Try to elbow out a little more room to operate on to give you more leeway in how you utilize it rather than have to utilize less.
Well, Oscar, how did you survive those drought Depression years in the 30s? What enabled you to come through?
Well, I think the thing that enabled me to come through possibly was that I started buying some additional land to go with what we basically had as nucleus. And as I look back, I see that I should have bought twice as much as I did.
Oscar, I want to conclude a little bit here. Just touch on when were you married then to Vivian?
Well, I was married in the late fall of 1930, and
so you began marriage right at the beginning of the Depression.
So I brought my family up through the tough years, And we had one son, and we cut the corners like most others did, and I think that my son grew up and knew how to take care of a dollar. And as I have gone on, and I do not decry it, I often thought that some of my family below me, I wish that a little touch of the depression could rub off on them, and give them a little bit of sense of the value of worldly goods.
Well, conditions forced you to return to the ranch, but your son is located back east today, isn't that correct?
Yes, he is, and he's worked. He took a job at General Electric after he got out of school. We gave him some help getting through school, but never did we have to back him up after he got out on his own. And I haven't, frankly, I haven't known for 10 years what his salary is, and I'll never ask him.
Oscar, as you look back, and just to conclude our discussion, as you look back, do you think the depression, drought, changed your life any?
Well, now I can... Yes, I think in a way it did. I mean, I'm not decrying having to had go through it, and I think that it made us more conscious of being maybe a little more saving, perhaps, than we would otherwise, and appreciate some of the good life that we enjoy nowadays. You take the average citizen today, he's living in a good period of time, and we all of us wish we had more, but there are few people in an area like this that are really have it too tough.